Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
All right. Hello, everybody. Happy Christmas week. Welcome to Others Receiving Votes. I'm your host, Pat Forty, joined by my amigos, Gene Wojciechowski and Brian Fisher. Hey, guys, who went 5-0 this week in the picks? Oh, that was me. Oh, you know, just thought we'd make mention of that off the top here. Thank you, James Madison, for the miracle backdoor cover.
Yes, thanks so much.
State, et cetera. What a happy Christmas week we have here since I have somehow risen from the dead picking games. But it was an interesting week of playoff games. We're going to cover that. We'll run down here the main topics on the show. Was the first round of the playoff actually good? We'll go through some winners and losers from the first four games. Are Nick Saban, Matt Leinart, and the other G6 haters right? We'll take the first glance at the quarterfinals. We will discuss an interesting schedule development and what it might mean. We'll check in on the Michigan coaching search and maybe toss a bone to the other bowl games out there before we hit a chimney caper to close. So, all right, guys, let's start, though, obviously, with the playoff. We finally got there. We had four games, one Friday, three on Saturday. Alabama staged a furious road rally to beat Oklahoma. Miami and Texas A&M played a game that sent offense back and special teams, frankly, for about five decades. Ole Miss's life after lane debut was a smash hit. And James Madison, as I noted, covered like a champion while getting basically run out of Autzen Stadium. So, was it actually any good? We ask our critics, our reviewers here. That's you guys. Taken as a whole, scale of 1 to 5 stars. What are you giving the first round and why? Gene, enlighten us.
Well, I'm giving you 0 stars for your nausea-inducing 5-0 rant. Thought we were just going to end the show right there. I'm going to give it 3 stars.
Okay.
Were the games great? Great? Memorable? Great? No, which is why I'm only giving them 3 stars. But I thought there were a lot of really compelling subplots. And I'll start with the Bama OU game. That was the one to me where we get most of the star power because of those subplots. You know, did Bama really deserve to be in the field? Could OU ever score? What's going to happen with Kalen DeBoer if they lost that game? So I thought there were a lot of things swirling around. And then you add the fact that Bama was down 17-0 in that game and then came back. And really, it wasn't that close by the end. It was just a huge Mongolian reversal by Bama. I thought gave that weekend some star power. And then moving ahead now, Bama playing Indiana is interesting to me. The other games, yes, Ole Miss, we had the Pete Golding. We all hate Lane Kiffin, Kumbaya there in Oxford. You were at that game, I believe.
Yep.
So, you know, you can talk about what that really felt like. And then, yes, Miami, Texas A&M set back the game for decades. But then the fourth quarter, especially those last few minutes, with, again, a nice subplot with Malachi Toney, that made it almost all worthwhile to me. And then, you know, yes, you had the blowouts. And I'll never forgive Oregon for the 99-yard. God, that just killed me. But anyway, I'm going with 3 stars. You know, was it a great 4 games? No, but I thought it deserved above average.
I'm giving your 3-star review 4 stars for throwing in the Mongolian reversal.
Thank you.
I will go with 4 stars because if you look back at last year, man, they were all blowouts. Every single one of the first round games. We didn't get the entertainment factor was a zero last year. So, based on what we saw, this past weekend, we're obviously way ahead of schedule, if you will, in terms of the playoff. And we get some bangers in terms of these quarterfinal matchups because of who won this past weekend, just in terms of the name brands, in terms of the matchups themselves, which I'm sure we'll get into. But, I was entertained, even in some of those blowouts. I mean, you look at that game against Ole Miss, Tulane moved the ball. You know, it was not like they were completely run off the field despite that final score. And, the second half against Oregon, that was definitely entertaining. And I think Dan Lanning does not get to – what's that?
It wasn't entertaining to me.
Well – Dan Lanning is not going to be on our Christmas card list. I will guarantee you that for pulling the starters as early as he did. And if you look in the second half of the game, you could tell that he got nervous. I think some Oregon boosters definitely had some money on there to cover because he put some of the starters back in that fourth quarter. So the entertainment factor was up there. And to me, Gino, you mentioned the Alabama Oklahoma game. I mean the narratives in that first quarter. I think there was a few people in the press box there. And Norman had columns already written about Kalen DeBoer by about midway through the second quarter. And man, did that get scrapped quickly. Cause I mean, that game turned on a dime and yeah. The atmosphere there was great. The Palace on the Prairie was rocking. 50 Cent was coming out and you kind of thought, all right, maybe that breathes a little life into things. But you have Tate Sendell, the All-American kicker, starting to miss kicks down the stretch. Oklahoma just self-destructing, really. Kind of the inverse of that first meeting between the two. So the entertainment factor was certainly there. The crisp, great playoff football, maybe not. But maybe that's what we are going to get in this second round with these quarterfinal matchups. Because I think that, to me, you could overlook all what happened in that first round if we get the type of games that we expect in the second.
I'm going to go about 3 stars, I think. Just the football itself was not wonderful. We had 7 missed field goals. We had a couple of block punts. The special teams were largely atrocious. The quarterback play was often bad, except for when it was good. But look, it was playoff football and it was on campus. And that to me is just such a game changer. Brian, like you said, you were there and it was awesome in Norman. It looked awesome on TV. It was incredibly awesome in Oxford. I mean, just great. And I was so struck, I guess, by people were just so happy and so positive. Like there was not this whole like screw Lane Kiffin. It was like, hey, we're in the playoff, man, and Pete Golding's our guy. Yeah. Let's ride. And just this great festive environment. And it was just it was funny to see. It was like 63 and sunny, which for most of us where we live or have lived, it's like, man, this is they're like bundled up in Mississippi. This gets the coldest home. Just, they don't play home games in December. The press box was cold. They might not have heat in the press box. They don't need it down there. But it was just this great celebratory atmosphere. And you get that when you were hosting a home playoff game. And so I love that element of it. I know it was the same way in College Station. I know it was the same way in Eugene. The games themselves, yeah, not overly compelling. The Miami-Texas A&M game was incredibly tense. Nobody could do anything right for quite a while, but, I mean, it was down-to-the-wire competitive and dramatic, that's for sure. And then, yeah, the Alabama comeback. And, look, I was one of those people who's like, this game is over. It's 17 to nothing. I said on the podcast, first one to 17 wins, and Oklahoma got there in about a blink of an eye. And I thought that thing was done. So kudos to Alabama for the great comeback. So I'm totally sold on the playoff format of playing on campuses. We're going to get some blowouts, and we'll get to that. We will discuss that very fact of life here as the show goes along. But give me this over any other formats we have seen and may in the future see. So I was totally in favor.
And Pat, from an entertainment factor, as someone who did not tweet out anything early in that Bama OU game, it was fun to watch all the people who had tweeted out things, mm-hmm. some of the snarkiness, have to do their own Mongolian reversals in social media. So that was fun to watch. And we had discussed last week the whole idea of those folks at Ole Miss, the energy, the positive energy, the excitement, the celebratory mood there was going to carry the day. And yeah. And you were there and you saw it, and it did carry the day. It was watching Pete Golden after that game, hearing him talk about Charlie Weiss Jr. There was a lot of pent up emotion, and it finally got a release after that win.
No doubt about it. There was. And the other thing I wrote about this that struck me actually as I was driving from Memphis to Oxford. It's the first playoff game, campus playoff game played in the Deep South. And it's at Ole Miss, which historically has been one of the laggards of SEC football. They've had some glory, but it was a long time ago. You know, never got to the SEC championship game. Even Mississippi State did that. Even Missouri did that twice. Even South Carolina did that. So for them to have this flag planting moment, you know, and not have it at Bryant-Denny or Tiger Stadium or Neyland or wherever, that was really cool. And I thought they embraced it to the hilt.
Even Tulane did it, didn't they? Back in the 30s or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Tulane, yes, your former SEC team back in the aughts or whatever. All right, so, but anyhow, looking at the winners and losers of the weekend, we'll go through a few of these. Brian, who was your biggest winner?
Well, you know, I'm tempted to say Pete Golding because of those reasons you just mentioned. I mean, I think we've both mentioned it not only on this podcast, but in writing as well, the pressure that he faced and to come out of that with, you know, essentially flying colors outside of maybe those injuries to his starting backfield early in that third quarter. You know, he definitely accomplished the task that was given to him. So I would put Pete Golding up there pretty high. I still think it's Miami and the ACC, though, in general. You know, all the talk surrounding, number one, the Hurricanes' inclusion to the playoff was a huge thing. You know, the ACC, this is their first playoff victory in nearly 5 years. You know, you got to remember that they've been missing out on that four-teamer for a couple of years. You know, Clemson struggled at times, you know, in some of those semifinal matchups, even before the pandemic. So this was a big victory, I think, for Mario Cristobal, for Miami. I'm not saying that Miami's back. I'm not saying anything along those lines. But I am saying that just in terms of the narratives surrounding this season, it was huge for Miami to go into College Station, look like the more physical team against an SEC program, and say, hey, we got to win. Now, we'll see what that means moving forward, given who they're matching up against in the Cotton Bowl. But I think it was just massive for Miami. Even though they had some self-inflicted mistakes, even though it looked like they were going to shank enough field goals to end up costing them there at the end, they came through when it mattered. And they came through with a couple of Miami kids, too. They've kind of invested heavily. They've made sure that they can be the face of the program, whether it be Malachi Toney, whether it be some of their defensive guys that really stepped up in that game. I think it was a huge statement of intent there for Mario Cristobal, what they've been doing with that program in this slow build to get over the hump and win a playoff game. I think it's massive for the Canes and massive for that ACC logo patch on their jerseys as well.
Biggest winner was a team that didn't even play. That is a selection committee from the CFP. So if we go back and let's think about the two teams that were most debated when it came to Notre Dame, it was Bama and it was Miami. And Bama and Miami got in, much to the disappointment and anger of Notre Dame. And both Miami and Bama won, and they both won on the road, by the way. And so I think that I don't want to say validated or vindicated the committee. It didn't do any of that. But if I'm a committee member today, I'm feeling pretty good about my choice there. We'll never know what Notre Dame would have done in the CFP. But we do know that the two teams the committee did choose acquitted themselves well.
Good point. Yeah, that was a couple of big showings by people that were under a lot of criticism starting into this thing. I'm going to say my biggest winner, it's the two guys, actually. I did a pressure gauge column last week heading in. The two guys I put under the most pressure in the playoff, both won, Pete Golding and Kalen DeBoer. And, you know, both, I think, absolutely needed to win, and they both had their teams come through for them. The DeBoer Alabama comeback was especially impressive, as we noted, on the road and, you know, in some fairly dire early circumstances, and they just flipped the script. And Oklahoma helped. The one dropping the punt snap and then getting that blocked was a big play. But Alabama made plays. They made big plays when they had to. So that showed something, I think, about kind of the, I mean, the, to me, what I've seen from Kalen DeBoer always, which was kind of a calm confidence. And I think his team reflected that. He knows he's a good coach. He's done it over and over and over in so many different places. He's been doubted. He's been criticized. He's probably deserved some of it because that team's been shaky at times under him. But
yeah,
but to win that game in that situation was super impressive. And then for Golding, yeah, and just if that game could not have started any more dreamily for Ole Miss and for Charlie Weiss Jr., who was calling the plays and not Lane Kiffin, the point that Golding made emphatically. And boom, four plays, touchdown. Next possession, three plays, touchdown. It's 14 to nothing. They've run seven offensive snaps, and the game was essentially over at that point. They, you know, Tulane stabilized and made it a game for a while, but it was clear that Mississippi was A, much better, but B, was ready to execute and perform at that stage. So, and Golding handled the whole thing really well and did his kind of Saban light afterwards, you know, where he'll talk a little bit like him and throw a little, aight. And he'll try to be mad when even you know he's not really mad, but he's like, the second team, you know, we put him in, we gave him some chances. All right, film's not going to be good. Film's not going to be good for them. It's like, all right, you just blew away your first playoff opponent, but he's doing what he's got to do. That's Saban 101 there. So those two guys were my biggest winners. But Gene, we have to get to the negative. We live in the negative here on this podcast. Who are the biggest losers?
Well, I feel terrible that that Summerall and Jesny, JMU and Tulane had to answer these questions. Basically, do you feel as if you deserve to be in the playoff? And I thought that was grossly unfair and disrespectful. And, you know, what did you expect them to do? Turn down the invitation to play in the playoff? So I never understood that, but I'm guessing you probably have your own very strong feelings about that. So I'll step aside on that. I would think the other loser, if you believe this idea that Kalen DeBoer is still somehow in play with Michigan, was the idea of Alabama winning that game prolongs this supposed or possible waiting game by Michigan to see if they can get DeBoer. So to me, that was a gut punch for any of these possible Michigan plan to wait out Bama and DeBoer in their coaching search.
I'm going to go with Texas A&M on this one. And I say that with the caveat that at least on Sunday, you know, the women's volleyball team did win a national title. So it was not a completely lost weekend there in College Station. But
true.
I mean, there was just the way their season ended, to go 11-0. To have, you know, one of the best runs that you've had there in College Station since, you know, the Johnny Manziel days, to look like your program has gotten back on track under Mike Elko, and then to lose your last two games to Texas, you know, your hated arch rival, in the manner that they did, and especially in that second half in Austin, and then to not score a touchdown, to have Marcel Reed throw two interceptions, including the backbreaker at the end of the game. I mean, that is just a rough way for the A&M fans to get everything built up for this huge moment in Kyle Field, to have, you know, 100,000, have this million-dollar kick on the line, you know, before the game with McAfee, and you know, all the atmosphere was there, and then to just, you know, kind of completely let the air out of the balloon. I mean, that's a tough look for the Aggies out there. And you know, I do give credit though to Mike Elko. You know, after the game, I mean, he was very, very resolute. You know, he very much talked about, you know, the future of the program, and you know, he said he was okay. You know, he would be okay after all of this. You know, what his biggest issue was, you know, just his players and how they felt, and you could see that on their faces as they walked off the field there in College Station after they talked. You know, I mean, you know, it was definitely something they would like back. And it's not just that one drive. I mean, it was just the end of the season. You know, you built yourself up, and to end like that's going to have some repercussions, I think, you know, at least on the psyche there for a lot of those Aggies fans moving forward.
As if their psyche hasn't taken enough hits over the decades. Yeah. That's the thing. I mean, whew, that was rough. That was a rough watch, and they almost pulled it off in the end, and it reminded me so much, completely opposite in terms of offensive pyrotechnics and lack thereof, but of the Notre Dame-Texas A&M game where they drove down the field in the last minute, and Marcel Reed threw the winning touchdown to Borkircher, and they're lining up for that play, and I'm like, they are throwing to Borkircher, and Miami knew it too, and intercepted the ball in the end zone. And I mean, tremendous defensive performance by Miami, but still, if you are Texas A&M with the offensive weapons that they had, and you score 3 points, that is a faceplant. I'm sorry, that's a tough loss, and it opens A&M up to, you know, the criticism of that they were a product of an easy schedule. Easy by SEC standards, where almost all their games were against the bottom half of the league, and that schedule was built on that. That doesn't mean, still, it's the SEC, and you did win all those games, and you did go to South Bend and win. So it's not like you say, oh, they didn't belong in the playoff, but their record now takes on a completely different hue, I think, based on the way they finished, and it does revive the criticism of Mike Elko as a late-season coach. His teams do not end the season as well as they start the season. That's been his history at Duke and now through 2 years at A&M as well.
Well, so. What was the final score? 10-3.
10-3.
You hold a team to 10 points and you lose.
Yeah.
That's tough.
That is very tough.
Especially with that offense, you know.
And you're losing all of your coordinators. You're losing several assistant coaches. Like, it's not just a terrible ending to the season. You know what? This has some program ramifications too for the Aggies.
I will say, I mean, in terms of losers, I'm going to say Colin Klein did not come out of that great. I mean, he's a guy who's done very well. He's a good coach. He's leaving to be the head coach at Kansas State, but my goodness, the product he put on the field there offensively on the way out, ugly.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love what's waiting for you at Sports Illustrated. Subscribe to the magazine now for unmatched stories, incredible photography, and deep dives you can't find anywhere else. Head to si.com/sipodoffer to sign up.
This is Michael Rosenbaum. Hey, folks, let me tell you that drinking and driving is a decision that will change your whole world. Things will never be the same once you get a DUI, because legal fees and time in court are just the beginning. Getting into a crash is another way your world could be irreversibly changed after drinking and driving. Your vehicle may not be the only thing that gets damaged in that crash. You could face a life-altering injury or even death. But you're not the only one who could face those consequences. Your decision to drink and drive could permanently change someone else's world, whether you injure them or leave their loved ones grieving. The next time you're out drinking, call a rideshare, a taxi, a sober friend, or a designated sober driver. Always plan for a safe ride home. The only decision that will change your world for the better is the decision to call for a sober ride. It's never worth it to drive drunk. Don't risk it. Drive sober or get pulled over. Paid for by NHTSA.
One other big loser, my mind. I lost it listening to the just over-the-top assaults on the inclusion of our G6 teams. And teams plural is part of the problem. Again, if the ACC had a more sensible tiebreaker and Miami had gotten in the championship game and won the championship game, this alleviates so much of the deal. Then James Madison is not in, and Notre Dame is in. And some of the screaming could stop. But even beyond that, people did not want Tulane in the field either. And we had Nick Saban saying they're playing AAA ball. And then we had Matt Leinart tweet during the JMU-Oregon game, "This is awful for our sport." Oh, my God. Seriously, get over your melodramatic selves. Like, we haven't seen any blowouts ever before. Like, we didn't see them last year when Tennessee got trampled, as we talked about on the podcast, when Oregon was behind 34-0 in the second quarter to Ohio State. Was that awful for the sport? Was anybody crying then? Oh, my God, look at this. It's terrible. So terrible to have these teams in here. We are talking about 50% of FBS getting 8% of the bids in a normal year. They get one, right, out of 12. And then when it goes to 16, it's still going to be one, and they're going to get 6% of the field for 50% for 68 teams. They're all battling for that one spot. And people want to begrudge them that so that we can get the 6th and the 7th team from the SEC in? I'm sorry, no. No, I'm not going for that. So that's this this just real drumbeat, I think, of let's just kick them out is where this is headed. And frankly, it's ticking me off. So this is going to be a constant point of discussion. And James Madison and Tulane did not do anything to change the discussion from that standpoint. I wish that one of them had played a little bit better, but they deserve to be there. That's the way this thing worked out. But the just almost hysterical criticism of one game, like this is ruining the playoff. It was one game, right? Okay, two games if you count James Madison and Tulane. But we're talking about an abnormality that I think is not going to happen again. So anyway, tell me I'm wrong, guys.
Well, and by the way, Notre Dame, if we stay at 12 games, and I think there's an adjustment if it increases, 12 teams. If the playoff is expanded, there'll be an adjustment also. But next year, there's a memorandum of understanding where Notre Dame will be guaranteed a spot in the playoff if they're ranked in the top 12 at the end.
Right.
And that the Power Four conference champions will be guaranteed a place in the playoff. So this really is a one-year situation. And so I'm with you, Pat. Do I think Notre Dame should have been in the playoff? Yes, it would have made for a better playoff. Do I have a problem with it that Tulane and JMU both got in? No, because guess what? That was just the protocol this year. That's how it worked out. It took like 12 different weird things to happen for JMU to end up in the playoff. So I'm with you. Just everybody just take a breath and exhale and we'll be fine. We'll be fine.
Well, the collective memory holding of how we have determined a national champion for the last century and a half in this sport and how haphazard it was, how crazy it was. I mean, we were debating decimal points back in the BCS days over what the computers were going to do. Like, I think we can at least acknowledge that there has been a positive impact on this national title chase and how we are determining, the sports champion. But the playoff itself was honestly, designed to get in the casual fan. And if we're going to get, if we want more casual fans to be interested in this sport and in everything that goes on during the regular season, you know what? We can live with some of the issues and some of the growing pains of this moving to this 12-team format. And we saw that this year. You know, like I'm with you, Pat. Like I hate this hand wringing over the group of five teams. Yes, they were, on a different playing field as they are at every time, but They earned it on the field. They did everything that was asked for them. You know, they are not at fault here. You know, it's the system that was at fault. And you know what? We still don't have a great sample size over how this is going to play, long term. I mean, I think if you had put Boise State in one of these games from last year, they would have had a chance against Ole Miss. You know, if you put that Boise State team from last year in that game in that first round. So to me, it is hand rigging. It's people that they're valuing the entertainment of these first round games over everything that has happened, transpired. You know, it's one game, one sample size compared to weeks and weeks and weeks worth of data, weeks and weeks of fans being interested in the sport, weeks of interest from fan bases that we didn't expect. And, I think it's honestly great that those James Madison fans, you saw them, you saw a ton of shots, especially in that second quarter and in the second half of them, being around Autzen, being able to travel out there for a playoff game. Like that is a great memory for a lot of people at James Madison who just moved up to FBS to have a shot at the playoff after, just transitioning from the FCS ranks. Like that's an awesome thing for the program. program. That's an awesome thing for those fans. And I think we can let the hand wringing and leave that to the off season. But for right now, let's just move forward and focus on the fact that this is never a sport that has been designed to really lean into determining a champion to everybody's benefit and acceptance.
Yeah, I mean, great point. Again, we are complaining bitterly about 11th and 12th when this used to be an issue of we couldn't even figure out for sure who the top two were. So yeah, we have come a long way, baby. All right, moving on to happier subjects. I'll try not to have an aneurysm in this segment.
Please.
The quarterfinals do look great, right? We've got some matchups that are awesome. The matchups, Alabama-Indiana in the Rose Bowl, Texas Tech, Oregon in the Orange Bowl, Mississippi, Georgia in the Sugar Bowl, and Miami, Ohio State in the Cotton Bowl. Excellent. Can't wait for this bunch. It's going to be New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. Favorite quarterfinal storylines. Brian, what do you got?
Man, I really can't overlook one of the games that I'll be at in the Cotton Bowl. You know, I think Miami and Ohio State, just the name brands between those two teams that, you know, really you go back maybe a couple months in the season, you know, right halfway through the season, both of these teams you could have circled and said, hey, they are both capable of winning in the national title. And so for them to meet, especially given the history of, you know, 2002, just the players on both of these rivalries. I'm sure Michael Irvin will be there, jumping up and down on his knees there at the Cotton Bowl, rooting on his Hurricanes. Like, the personalities involved in these two teams. I think it's going to be a clash of the Titans. I can't wait for that game, just on the field in terms of the product that we could see from both the Miami and Ohio State. I think really all the quarterfinals have some great matchups. I mean, you look at that Texas Tech Oregon game. You know, you talk about the nouveau riche of college football programs nowadays and what they've been spending on their roster, what they've been spending on facilities. These are two of the poster boys in terms of the programs that have lifted themselves up from the doormat and to not only be able to have a great season this year, but really look primed for success. I think the Orange Bowl is going to be fantastic. Everybody knows the Rose Bowl, obviously. Between one of the losingest programs in college football history versus, you know, the King Kong of the past couple of decades in Alabama, you really cannot go wrong in any of these quarterfinals. And I think that is, you know, kind of the flip side of the first round is, man, did we get some absolutely great matchups here for this second round.
I love the Crimson on Crimson game. Yeah. And I love that it's in the Rose Bowl. And I love that the roles have been reversed, as Brian sort of mentioned. Number one seeded Indiana. You know, I started to say Alabama just out of habit. So I think that's just a fascinating matchup. All the other games are great. You can make an argument for each one. But that one in particular really intrigues me. And mostly because I still don't know how good Alabama is, but I'm beginning to become a little bit of a believer. And Pat, you mentioned it earlier with Kalen DeBoer, his record in these big games. It's like a record James Franklin would give him half of his salary for. He's remarkable in those games and against those kind of ranked opponents. So I'm really curious, is Bama back? Is this team coming together? Is it going to be able to play the spoiler against IU? I love the subplots of that game, and you can never go wrong with any game at the Rose Bowl. So that's the game that intrigues me most right now, the quarterfinals.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. And just how is Indiana going to, you know, where the target as the number one seed, the undefeated team against an Alabama that's like, yeah, been there, done that. Indiana fans are going to be walking around like they are absolutely in Shangri-La, and Alabama fans like, yeah, we do this every year. So that one's going to be great. But I love Texas Tech, Oregon.
Yeah.
That that is fresh and it's fascinating. And I want to see the Oregon offense with Dante Moore that showed some of their real potential, I thought, against JMU, against the Texas Tech defense, which is just a wrecking crew. That matchup, the two sides of it, I am fired up for that. And, yes, Miami, Ohio State. I wonder if that pass interference flag may come up from 2002 at all leading into that. Probably not. Probably not a, not a thing.
I wouldn't think so.
No, no. Everybody's forgotten about it. Certainly on the Miami side.
Exactly.
I don't think about it. All right, guys, we're going to pick those games next week, but let's take a quick look just at the spreads. And I want to give you, want you to give me an underdog you like best. We've got some pretty fat spreads here. We got one close game according to Vegas, but we've got Miami and Ohio State. Ohio State favored by 10. Oregon, Texas Tech, Red Raiders, or I'm sorry, Ducks favored by 1.5. Alabama, Indiana, Hoosiers favored by 7. And in no world we have ever inhabited before would that be the case.
Yeah.
But this is it now. And then Ole Miss and Georgia, Bulldogs favored by 7. So some pretty big spreads there. What underdog is going to win, Gene? Who's going to pull off an upset?
Well, we're not picking this right now, right?
No, no, so we're not like doing.
I reserve the right to change my mind, but just going sort of by the underdog chalk, it's hard not to look at Texas Tech and that 1.5 point. I mean, basically a pick'em game in many ways, and not think that Texas Tech could be that team. I'm not sure they deserve underdog status, but technically they are. So that would be the team. And mostly because I think defense travels. And they have a defense that has traveled all over and shut everybody down just about. And so I'm not going to get my shorts in a bunch by what JMU did as far as yardage and points in that second half of that game against JMU. I still think they're an absolutely terrific offense. But that is going to be strength on strength. And if anybody can maybe slow down Oregon's offense, I think it's Texas Tech's defense. And so right now, that would be the team I think could be the upset team, if you want to even call it that.
Well, especially so because, you know, both teams are getting healthy in that matchup. You know, Oregon getting some of their wide receivers back and possibly even more than what we saw in that first round meeting against JMU. So, you know, a more dangerous Oregon offense versus the Texas Tech team that, you know, I think this time off could really help, you know, Barron Morton as he's recovering from that leg injury. You know, it seems like his mobility is still somewhat limited. So if he's, you know, really fully ready to go and kind of the same version that we saw early in this season, not only does that defense travel, but Texas Tech has that offense to make this quite the compelling game and quite that opener on New Year's Day. But, you know, to me, I also look at Miami, you know, and I think, you know, people are coloring, you know, the lines. But if you're talking about, do they have a good defensive line that can get after the quarterback? Yes. Do they have a running game that can travel? Yes, it looks like that they showed that in that win over Texas A&M. So to me, you know, if you're talking about actually talent, and I know it's a big line at 9.5, and everybody's looking at Ohio State as this unbeatable juggernaut, but you know what? They got punched in the mouth against Indiana in that Big Ten title game, and you know, you can say all you want about some missed field goals late. You know, they did end up losing that game. Miami, they have the pieces at least to maybe pull the upset there in the Cotton Bowl, especially if, as we saw last year, if some of these quarterfinal teams look a little rusty. You know, I think that factor cannot be denied, whether it's Georgia, whether it's Indiana, whether it is Texas Tech, even if they did play in their conference title games, what is that kind of rust factor going to be like, you know, especially just given the way the schedule is set up in terms of where these games are played and when they are played. So give me Miami and give me Texas Tech as potential upsets there in that quarterfinal round.
It's a good point, Brian, that the teams on the longer layoff last year did not show up and play well in the quarterfinals. So we'll see if that was a product of the weird seeding or if it's a product of the other team being sharper and fresher. That'll definitely be a storyline to watch. I tell you what, the underdog that I think is dangerous is Mississippi against Georgia. They're a 7-point dog there. If you recall, when they played in Athens during the regular season, Ole Miss led by 9 points in the fourth quarter. And then Georgia just avalanched them to the end. They scored the last 17 points and won the game. And people kind of thought, you know, in retrospect, oh, well, that was a pretty comfortable win. But Ole Miss, I mean, moved and scored against the Georgia defense. Maybe Georgia's better now than it was then. But the Mississippi team that I saw on the field Saturday was awfully good. Both sides of the ball, but especially on the offensive side, they look like they can put some schemes and some players on the field that can give problems for the Georgia defense. So big number. I think it might be a little too big a number, but again, we'll get around to picking the games next week on the show.
That though, Pat, that Georgia team is a team that really needed the extra time off.
Yeah.
I think that really benefits them. I think their defense has gotten better as the season's gone on. I don't disagree with you with anything you're talking about with relative to Ole Miss. We do have the Pete Golding factor now here against, you know, the team that just won't die, Georgia.
Yeah.
And so that's a really compelling story too. So, but yeah, good point by you.
Yeah. I mean, I think these are going to be great quarterfinals across the board. So, all right, guys, a little scheduling news. We'll drop it in here.
What do we got?
Pretty hot news. Just come out at noon today.
Okay.
Notre Dame has announced a 2-year agreement to play BYU. Two schools that just narrowly missed out on the playoff. Both kind of thought they maybe should be in. Both have had really good runs the last few years.
Wow.
They're going to play next year in Provo, and they're going to play 2027 in South Bend. Now,
what does that mean?
Well, what does it mean? Let's extrapolate from here. And as Notre Dame has added these games, you look at the schedule, they've already got 12 written on the schedule with a basically TBD against USC in the last game of the year. If you're adding BYU, what needs to go? Probably USC, and probably for the year after that. And all of a sudden you're looking and saying, oh my God, they're really going to do this. They're really going to kill off one of the great rivalries in the history of college football. That's the way it appears. And again, I would throw this largely at the feet of USC for mucking with the rivalry in terms of wanting to move it around on the schedule. I know there'd been discussion about playing week zero, which, you know, fine. I mean, if you have to play week zero, fine, but I think it's terrible. I would much rather see them continue to play the way they have for 60 plus years. October in South Bend, Thanksgiving weekend in Los Angeles. But I think we are looking at the high, high potentiality, if not certainty, that Notre Dame and USC will stop playing each other for at least a few years. Your reactions, gentlemen.
Well, I hope Matt Leinart tweets about this one. Because I think this is worse than...
yeah, talk about awful for the sport.
Yeah. If it turns out the way that you're laying it out, that it could possibly happen, I just think it's a sad day in college football. I hope you're wrong, but it sounds like that certainly is a real possibility. And I just don't understand how it got to this.
Yeah,
I don't understand why you wouldn't want to protect one of the great rivalries in college football. It benefits both of them. It really does. It's just, it's that good of a rivalry. And so I don't get it. I understand the realities of scheduling, but this one just feels self-inflicted, and then stubbornness set in. So I hope you're wrong, but it sure sounds like you might be right on this, Pat.
Yeah, I'm disappointed along with you guys. I mean, you know, that is the rivalry in college football. When you think of the great things, you know, just the history attached to it, the players attached to this, and to have that go away, even if it's a 2-year break, and we have seen that in the past where, all right, you have these historical long rivalries, and then they go away for a year or two, but they do come back. You mentioned BYU. I mean, they had their break in the Holy War with Utah for a couple of years. They played Michigan, you know, for a 2-game series. I believe they played some other non-conference opponent as well from the Power Four. So we have seen these type of breaks. I'm just disappointed that it's USC and Notre Dame. And look, Fighting Irish. I mean, they cannot stay out of the headlines. You know, it's like they wanted to crawl themselves, you know, back into the discussion in college football after, you know, spending a weekend kind of absent-minded, you know, from everybody's front of mind in terms of the sport. But it's just disappointing for fans, number one. You know, I think for the players, you know, not to be able to go experience, if you're a USC Trojan, to go out to South Bend or even have them come to the Coliseum. I mean, it's just disappointing. And I get it. I understand the scheduling realities, and I understand how much more difficult it is if you are Pete Bavakwa, the Notre Dame AD, to schedule nowadays, given what the ACC agreement has looked like. And on top of everything going on, you're playing Wisconsin and Lambeau Field this year or next year. You know, you have some of your other rivalries that you got to consider in terms of Stanford. They just signed that deal with Clemson. So I get that scheduling can be difficult as a football independent. But for both sides to let this go, we got to throw the dirt on both sides on this one for even getting to this point to where this is a possibility.
Yeah, it's incredibly disappointing. I think and nobody wins, that's for sure, in this situation. And everybody can make a justification. Well, this is why we had to do it. But the fact of the matter is, your talk about harming college football, this would harm college football. Notre Dame, look, they scheduled BYU, they've scheduled Texas, they've scheduled Clemson, they've scheduled Auburn, so they are still managing to schedule some games. But dang it, you got to have that USC game on there. And I'm mad at USC for a number of reasons on this. I mean, I'm mad at them for the fact that they are in the Big Ten, which helped destroy the Pac-12 and helped create this situation where, like, oh my gosh, we can't keep traveling to the Midwest. That's a you problem. You said yes to the deal. You said, yes, we're going to go play in Piscataway, and we're going to go play in State College, and we're going to play in Iowa City. But now all of a sudden, we can't play Notre Dame too.
And it's not every year.
No, it's not.
So,
anyway, significant news that once again tells us that not everybody has the best interests of college football as a whole at heart when it comes to these things. But USC, I'm sorry, I've got to add a little bit more, but it's just they've treated traditions as such a disposable thing. You know, they have, to leave the Pac-12 and join the Big Ten, and then, like, no, we don't need Notre Dame unless they'll schedule us week zero in Las Vegas or something. That's garbage. Crap. Let's check in at Michigan. Things are moving at a deliberate pace, if they're moving at all. Which you guys, is most likely the reason why they are not necessarily sprinting towards hiring a new coach. Is it department chaos, or are they slow playing it while someone is still coaching, either in college or the NFL? My theory is department chaos. I think that there is enough uncertainty there about who is in charge, about whether Ward Manuel is going to keep his job as this external review continues of the athletic department. And I think that as long as that's ongoing, it's really hard to even say, Ward, go hire us a coach. You know, this is just a difficult situation. And from what I was told by somebody, an agent, they can't even figure out whether there's a number one candidate. So Kenny Dillingham re-upping with Arizona State, Kalen DeBoer still being the Alabama coach. Do they have an idea where they want to go, and do they have an idea who is leading the direction there? I suspect it's internal more than external about why this thing is the way it is.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you look at Biff Poggi, the interim coach. You know, I think as this search drags out longer and longer, the growing likelihood that he ends up being the guy in at least 2026, I think grows by the day. I mean, not just in terms of his respect within that program, in terms of what he's been able to do, how he gets everybody kind of on the same page, how he's navigated this past couple of weeks. He's well respected by, I think, the administration, by the players. And I don't think that's great for Michigan long term if they were to kind of do that kind of interim situation or anything like that. But, they're reaching the point where, you got to make a decision at some point, and somebody, whoever that is, that is ultimately the final decision maker on this. I think if there is not somebody to emerge, now I do think, Jed Fish is a strong candidate and has at least had some conversations with Michigan. We'll see, what ultimately becomes of those. I think there's a few other names that they've at least talked with. This is not a search, as for all the departmental chaos, as you mentioned, Pat, it does seem like the search is progressing, which is kind of the weird dichotomy of this situation, that you have all the chaos back in Ann Arbor, but I guess externally there is at least movement on the search. And I do think there's been a bit of a reset after the weekend. I think they definitely were waiting on Kalen DeBoer to see, hey, maybe there is a shot there. Obviously, that has been thrown out the window with what happened with Alabama and the timing of things. But to me, this is not where Michigan wanted to be. This is not where Michigan hoped to be. But this is where Michigan finds themselves at, and how they navigate this, how they try to wiggle their way out of it, is going to be fascinating, and really kind of hanging over not just things in Ann Arbor, but really the sport over the next couple of days as we head into to really the holiday weekend.
Either Michigan is doing a fantastic job of keeping all this secret, or they are in total chaos. There can't be an in-between. So either they have somebody that they're targeting and they're just waiting for, maybe it's an NFL person, maybe it's somebody in the playoff right now, that they're just waiting for that to finish up. If they wanted to hire Jed Fish, please, somebody explain to me why they haven't already announced it then. If they wanted to hire Dillingham says he wasn't offered the job. Now, we all know how that works. There's this game of semantics and, well, we're not really going to offer you the job. Would you take it if we did? I mean, there's a million things that could have happened there. Bottom line is Dillingham isn't going to be the next Michigan coach. You hear Kyle Whittingham's name now, the Utah coach who resigned. If they wanted to hire him, what are they waiting for? So my question is, if they really do have somebody in mind who's not in the playoff and who's not in the NFL, they could announce that right now. They have not. So I don't know where they're going with this. I don't know who's making the decision, but either they are doing a fantastic job of keeping it all under wraps, or they don't know.
Yeah, this is an ongoing saga, to say the least, of what's going to happen there. And I think we all have had some interaction with Biff Poggi. He's an interesting guy. He's charming and fascinating. He also went 6-16 at Charlotte. And if he ends
Pat, I spent a lot of time with Biff. I did a... when I was with ESPN, I did an E60 piece on him where literally spent day after day with him, multiple times going back when he was coaching a St. Francis Academy, which is a predominantly black high school in inner city Baltimore. And he poured his heart and soul and lots of his own money into that program and turned it into a national powerhouse. Before that, he had been a very successful high school coach at a prep school in Baltimore area. He was at Michigan several times with Jim Harbaugh and was sort of the governor switch, the voice of reason to Harbaugh as best as he could be. And then he went to Charlotte, which was a very tough job. So I give him a bit of a pass there. But we have heard players now, past and present, with that Michigan program, who have come out and said, you know what, Biff Poggi would be a good solution. Long term, I don't know. But short term, medium term, I think you could do a lot worse than Biff Poggi. And I think he has a lot of credibility in that program. And I also think he's a guy with a lot of integrity and compassion and empathy. And I also think he's smart enough to surround himself with with people who could coach offense and defense. So if that's where they ended up, and Brian mentioned it earlier, I think you could do a lot worse given the situation right now.
It could be. I mean, we'll see. If you're going to tell me we're going to whiff on Kalen DeBoer and Kenny Dillingham, and we're going to hire a guy who was 6-16 at Charlotte, I'm going to remain slightly skeptical that it's going to work.
Fair enough. Absolutely fair.
So anyway, we'll see. That will be an ongoing saga that will keep the podcast busy. All right, guys. One other topic to hit real quick before we hit the last topic, but. A bunch of bowl games going on other than the playoff. They do keep us busy. They keep ESPN full of content. They keep gamblers occupied. Give me one game, non-playoff bowl game, that you're excited to see in the coming days here.
Well, I'll start. How about that warm-up act for the Cotton Bowl in terms of the Vegas Bowl? Nebraska versus Kyle Whittingham's swan song there for Utah. And I'm sure there will be quite a few emotions for the Utes there saying goodbye to their head coach, but also for Matt Rhule. I mean, this is supposed to be kind of the building block year, you know, where that Nebraska team makes a leap. And now you have he's fired the offensive line coach. He's seen his quarterback, Raiola, leave for the transfer portal. They've slid certainly in the second half of the season after looking quite promising, you know, in the first half of the year. So this is a big game for both Nebraska and Utah. So I'd kind of circle that one as a nice little warm-up act there before we get kickoff in Dallas for Miami and Ohio State.
Well, we've got the national championship that never was. Penn State against Clemson. but I'm going to go with, even though I do have some Diego Pavia fatigue, I'm very intrigued by the Iowa-Vanderbilt game. And especially given the post-Heisman fallout surrounding Pavia. But even without that, I would say that's a really interesting game. Styles. Philosophies, personalities. I think there's a lot to like about that game.
Yeah, I'm with you. Good choices, both of you guys. Give me the Pop-Tarts Bowl, Georgia Tech, BYU. As noted, the Cougs were close to making the playoff, and I want to see them in that game that Notre Dame declined to play in.
Yeah.
And I want to see Georgia Tech, which for quite a while this season, looked like a potential playoff team. And I want to see Haynes King's last ride there as quarterback of the Yellow Jackets. I have loved Haynes King, watching him play.
Good choice.
As tough a guy out there as I have seen this season. That dude, just like, give me the ball. I'm running straight ahead, and I'm going to do it 15 times a game. Stop me. It's going to be third and one. I'm going, and I'm not juking and jiving. I am going straight through you to get the first down. And he has just been – kind of the engine of the revitalization of Georgia Tech. So give me him in one more college football game, and give me BYU. I think that's going to be fun. That's 3:30 on the 27th of December. So this next Saturday, tune in for that. So, all right, some fun games there to keep your eyes on. As always, plenty of bowl action. But one other story, guys. Christmas adjacent story, if you will. AP, our friends at AP, they're always on it. Firefighters had to rescue a man who got stuck in the chimney of a Connecticut Parks building while trying to retrieve his dog from a bathroom when the doors automatically locked for the night. There's a lot going on here. It's not fully explained, but a park in Connecticut, it was a burglary complaint, and they went in and they found a guy stuck in the chimney, and they had to remove part of the chimney to get to the guy.
Sure.
Yeah. And the guy's like, he was not hurt, but they're like, what are you doing? He said, well, my dog is in the bathroom and the doors are locked. I don't know why his dog was in the bathroom and he was not, but that was the case. And they got him out. The doors automatically lock at 10 p.m. every night.
Right.
So dog ends up in there, Guy does not end up in there. Guy tries to go through the chimney. Good effort, good hustle. You know, dog probably would have been okay overnight, but he was not going to leave the dog behind. Now, here's the twist.
There's a twist. Okay.
Dateline, Bristol, Connecticut. Which ESPN personality was this who got stuck in the chimney?
No, really?
No. But if you had to pick one.
It would have been a much better story of had it actually been.
I know, yes. If it were really Chris Berman, it would have been a great story. But most likely ESPN personality to end up in a chimney attempting to extricate a dog. Anybody? Any nominations?
I'm going to recuse myself from this one. For all the... all the reasons that you can imagine.
Yeah. Brian, well, you got to
have at it.
I'm just trying to think of like all the people that would actually like be up for doing this, you know, like I feel like Matt Berry, you know, he's just adventurous enough to say, you know what? I can rescue the dog. I can go through the chimney. So it takes, you know, like you kind of got to get over the mental hurdle of saying, what am I about to do? And so I think that might be my answer, but especially because I believe he lives in Connecticut. So that it just nobody comes to mind otherwise. But I know why Gino is recusing himself, but I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I've got a few nominees. My former ESPN and former Missouri classmate John Anderson has the athleticism to do it. He was a high jumper, believe it or not, in college. But I think I'm going to go with Quint Kesnich. You know, kind of a more compact, wiry, up for a challenge.
He would have torn down the chimney. You seen that guy?
Yeah, no.
Built like a chimney.
Yes. And, you know, he's done some of the, you know, he'll do the adventurous stuff. So I could see him saying, hey, Quint, we need to get a dog out of a locked bathroom, and there's only one way in. All right, I'm going. I'm going down the chimney. So that's my vote there.
All right.
You know, clearly, unfortunately, there was no ESPN personality involved that I can tell, but I just thought we would extrapolate from there. Why not? This podcast doesn't have to be based in reality. It rarely is. That's it. All right. That's enough of this show. Enjoy your Christmas week, everybody.
Yes, happy
if you're traveling,
holidays.
If you're seeing family, whatever you're doing, if you got to work, we're with you. Give us a listen, and we will be back next week. Happy holidays. Thanks for listening.
This isn't just a game. It's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.